Let's do it.
Good stuff. This was the original title of my talk, but I got remixed a little bit by Tim. So, if anyone came for the love bit, might have the wrong idea. So, I won't be offended if you leave. But yeah, so it's about that's a play on the famous Stanley Kubrick movie title, obviously. I'm going to be talking about algorithmic game content generation, so the generation of graphics, art, and other media and stuff like that in games. And today, basically my aim is to bake a cake. I'm going to be trying to bake a cake inside your heads, metaphorically speaking, of course. I'm going to show you a whole bunch of different ingredients, and my hope is that we can, I've got to go through the talk pretty fast, so it'll be like a really fast mixer. And hopefully at the end of it, we'll come out with a cake inside your heads and we'll all go off and code lots of algorithmic content stuff into our open source games. So basically, during this talk, I'm going to be trying to cover these points. What is procedural content generation? What can be generated procedurally in a game? Why do we want to do this? And how do we use these algorithms practically in games? I'll address the first one now. Procedural content generation is, as opposed to when you have artists working on a game who hand create every single asset in the game. So they hand create all the 3D models, they hand create all the textures, or if it's a 2D game, all the 2D art. You have musicians who hand create the soundtrack, sound effects artists who hand create the sound effects. Instead of doing that, you're writing code that takes a general idea of what something is and makes as many as you want of them. So, the kinds of things which you can generate are behaviors as well as the content. So, the way that the non-player characters in their game move around and stuff like that, and also effects, so special effects. I'm just going to give a brief timeline of the games industry since the 1960s. In the early 1960s, around the time of the PDP-1, this group of dudes from MIT made a cool little game called Space War. Has anyone seen screenshots of this? Has it? Oh, really? I was going to say, has anyone played it?
Played in the 60s.
this game actually had a procedural content generation in it. The ships were actually made from sine and cosine routines. They were put together to make these little spaceship shapes. But the idea of the game was you had the planet, and you had another player, and you had toggle switches on the front of the PDP-1. Correct me if I get this wrong. And you had to...
it was 40 years ago.
You have to toggle it one way, and the ship would spin one way, toggle it the other, the ship would spin the other way, and you're trying to shoot each other down while interacting in the gravity of this body that's in the center of the screen. So, something interesting led on for this. In 1969, when the PDP-7 came out, this guy called Ken Thompson, who you might have heard of, he was so impressed with this baseball game that he wrote one called Space Travel, which was like a much more realistic planetary simulator. It had a few different bodies. I don't think it had a combat element in it. I think it was more of a simulator. But, and then shortly after that, he wrote something we know as Unix. And one of the first things he ported to Unix with a friend who went by the name of Richie, some of you might know, have heard of him, was Space Travel. So it was one of the first Unix programs. Is that right?
So now we're putting Linux on games consoles and become full circle.
Yeah, that's right. We've gone the whole other way around now. We're putting Linux back on games consoles.
Just an aside on that, that was one of the first reasons why game consoles now have really good buttons and things, because we broke the buttons off the PDP-11.
Yeah, right, okay. So it made them more durable. Yes.
Just a quick aside, could everybody speak really loudly so that we can capture it on the tape?
No problem!
Cool.
Could you turn the sound notch too? It's hard to hear as well.
I'll just get you to talk really loudly, Chris.
Yep. So the PDP-1 was actually, I think it might have been the first, or was one of the first definitely, examples of coded game rather than one which was made in circuitry. An example of a game made in circuitry, well, let's move to the 1970s. Games in the 70s started being developed by one or two people. I think the Atari 2600 came out in 1978, so yeah, it was a big decade for games. Pong, Asteroids, Space Invaders, and of course Steve the Woz Wozniak made Breakout in 4 days, and his good pal Steve Jobs got paid, I think it was $5,000, as a bonus for completing this in 4 days. He did excellent, effective man management, obviously. And he paid the Woz like $750 or something. Oh, no. Yeah, he paid him $750, which he said was half of what he got paid. Nothing's changed. So back during the 70s, art, music, and etc. were all hard-coded into the circuitry. Were often hard-coded into the circuitry. So things would be programmed, but you'd also have a lot of hardware on chip to do things like music and stuff like that. The 1980s, you start seeing the IBM XT, stuff like that coming to prominence, and IBM clones, and these graphical adventure games, point and click and stuff like that, Space Quest and King's Quest and all those from Sierra Games. You find those. And these had sprites for the first time, well, not the first time, but these had much more complicated sprites, so you had artists being able to design things like they couldn't before with like 16 colours and stuff. There was an example of a game from this time on the Commodore 64 called Elite, which had procedurally generated worlds. I don't know if... Does anyone here remember Elite? Yeah. I think it was on the Amiga too, wasn't it?
Yeah. A friend made it on the PC.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was one of the later ones.
Yeah, so that was an early example of a procedurally generated game. In the 90s, something crazy happened when we moved to 3D. I think Wolfenstein was released in 1988, and so we went all 3D and we started having to make much bigger teams to create all the assets in the game. Wolfenstein actually just had sprites that were always front on, but so the first person shooter was born, which kind of changed everything. Hundreds of assets per game. Back in the Wolfenstein days, there were hundreds of assets per game. And then we hit 2000, and we get games like GTA, which have movie-sized budgets. So the thing is, like, how do we keep up with that? We're writing open-source games. We don't have those kind of resources. Lots of us don't even know any artists. Yeah, how do we keep up with this? How do we create assets ourselves without having access to those kind of resources? So that's the whole aim of my talk, is to try and put some ideas in your head to generate assets. So the idea is to generate complexity from simplicity. We're trying to write simple algorithms that have complex emergent output. Here's some examples of simplicity and chaos. So here's chaos. Here's order, and this is a complexity. She sure is.
Recognize it right away.
So complexity is somewhere in between chaos and order. It's hard to define. It's hard to say what complexity is because it's tied into the way that we perceive things and patterns that we see and stuff like that. So basically, if you want to try and define it, you could say it requires CPU time to generate, rather than being a packed format of just a bunch of data. You've got to actually generate the data on the fly using your algorithm, and rather than having humans generate that data. It's non-linear, so you have systems which don't, which have memory, systems which don't always respond in the same kind of way, so you get emergent behaviors. I'll show you an example of that a bit later. It's high-dimensional, so you have lots of different variables going into into your complex system. And small changes in the initial state yield vastly different outcomes. So the old butterfly effect, if the butterfly flaps its wings in Nigeria, you get a hurricane somewhere else. So those are the kinds of things we're trying to discover. And the reason for that is because they're interesting. Chaos isn't very interesting, and order at the other end of the spectrum isn't very interesting. But if you can get patterns emerging out of the combination of those two, then you've succeeded. John Hopkins was talking about SimCity, and he said, people naturally attribute cause and effect relationships to events in SimCity that Will, as a programmer, knows are not actually related. So this is what emergent behavior is, when you program something, but you get something way more complex and unpredictable coming out of it. And I think another example of this might be in Quake, when you get these dudes doing the Quake runs, Quake Done Quick and all that. Do you guys know about that? Basically, people try and exploit the physics of the game Quake to get through the levels quickly and cheat and do all kinds of cool stuff. Will Wright, I'll probably mention him a couple of other times in this talk because he's one of the big proponents of this, said, the one thing that all the sim games really emphasize more than anything else is the shape of chaos. You can have what seems like a fairly simple system, but a few things interacting can lead to wildly unpredictable behavior. So that's exactly what you're talking about. Shape of chaos, making it more interesting rather than just randomness. Will writes The Sims is the top-selling game of all time. And if we look at other games that do really well, they all have an element of this emergence. They're not they've got something happening behind the scenes. This is, if anyone can focus on that, one of those 3D seeing eye things. It's actually a Mandelbrot set. Did I see the page yet?
It's a sailboat.
seem to have lost a page. Oh no, here we go. Alright, so fractals. We all know what fractals are. We've all seen a Mandelbrot set. We've all done those zooming programs into them. They look pretty. The definition of a fractal is a geometric object which has a Hausdorff and Bessukovich dimension greater than its topological dimension. I don't know what the hell that means.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So in 1975, this guy Benoit Mandelbrot coined the term fractal to describe some maths he was interested in. But before him, he was writing a book at the time called How Long is the Coast of Britain? Statistical Self-Similarity and the Fractal Dimension. So he was looking at the mathematics of self-similarity, which is what fractals are all about. There are a couple of other guys working with him, Gaston Maurice Julia, Leibniz, and Louis Fryer Richardson. Gaston Maurice Julia, the Julia fractal's named after him. So that's a four-dimensional fractal, I think. And Leibniz was concerned with recursive self-similarity, so systems that are self-similar recursively. And Louis Fryer Richardson was interested in coastlines. So the main points of fractals are down here: iteration, self-similarity. So doing something many times, running the same result through the same system again and again, and getting systems that are similar to themselves at different levels, different dimensions. So. So what are fractals good for? That's not where I'm at. Okay, so there are three different types of basic fractal. So the one we all know is the Mandelbrot fractal, which is escape time fractal. You take a point, you have an area, and you take every single point in that area, and you iterate a function for each point. And if it shoots off into the nowhere, it's a 1. If it stays within the same location, it's a 0. And you get these weird patterns emerging. That's what an escape time fractal is. That's one we've all seen. Iterated function fractals are stuff like the Koch curve. There's nothing to draw on the board. Yeah, there is. So that's basically like...
I think it's left over from the last one you worked at.
Okay. So you draw the Koch algorithm is basically on every face turn it into a triangle. So you start off with a triangle, and then each face of this triangle you draw a triangle on it. And then each one of those, you have another little triangle. So little triangles pop out here. you get this thing that quickly snowballs into something really amazingly complicated. And you can get crazy 3D ones of these. I'm sure you guys have seen them. They're like, you know, the sponges that have an infinite number of cubes in them and stuff like that. My friend had this idea for a infinite fractal Coke bottle where you could just hold an infinite amount of Coke in it. I haven't made that one yet. So, how do we use fractals in games? The two main uses are generating height maps for landscapes, and the other one is L-systems. L-systems, I haven't seen that much use, but they're pretty cool. This down here, I believe, is a Julia fractal rendered in three dimensions. Julia fractals are really cool because you can, because they're four-dimensional fractal, you can animate them through time using the fourth dimension as time. So you can get these weird warping effects. Yeah, I've got heaps of demos for this, and I'm just trying to remember if I've skipped one. No, I haven't yet. Okay. This is a quote here. If you already know what recursion is, just remember the answer. Otherwise, find someone who's standing closer to Douglas Hofstadter than you are. yeah. So, Douglas Hofstadter has a whole book full of this kind of stff called Gödel, Escher, and Bach, The Eternal Golden Braid. I'm sure some of you have read it. It's a pretty amazing book. Yeah, so let's move on to procedurally generating landscapes. Stochastic fractal. That's the... Actually, I didn't talk about the three types fully, did I? I talked about escape time and iterated function. The third type of fractal is a stochastic fractal, so one where you have an element of randomness in your iterations. So to generate a landscape, what you do is you start out with a plane or a triangle, so a simple shape, and then you divide it into smaller planes or triangles. So say from the midpoint of each point of each triangle, of each piece of the triangle, you make another triangle. And each time you do that, you move the midpoint up or down randomly. And you keep doing that, so you can start out with this massive triangle like this, and you split it into smaller and smaller bits, and you end up with something that's interesting, you know, it's like kind of wavy and interesting. I'll just show a quick... this is installed in Debian by default. Someone's obviously done this. They've got the planar one, and it just keeps recursing until you get really fascinating shapes like that. That's one of the big things that it's used for, is terrain generation. And you can actually get terrain generation programs which just generate landscapes for you. So this isn't an accurate model of real geological processes. So you get interesting landscapes, but you don't get terribly realistic landscapes. And they're quite uniform. You can start doing other things to eliminate that. So I don't have time to go into all the different things you can do, but basically things like not just moving the points up and down, using the normal of the last plane to move in that direction. It'd be interesting to see if someone came up with a fast system for accurately modeling geological processes to make landscapes. That would be amazing. You have scale issues. But you can use a level of detail algorithm to deal with this. So what a level of detail algorithm does is, when an object is in the distance, so a 3D mesh is in the distance, it finds the minimum number of points in that 3D mesh that it has to compute, and just draws those ones, just calculates those. There's a couple of them. There's Roam, which splits triangles recursively until the required level of detail is reached. So it starts out with just the outline of the object, and then it goes in and in and in, and makes more and more detail until... So if you're close up, it'll draw heaps of polygons. If you're far away, it'll draw fewer. Or adaptive quad trees, which create a data structure, which lends itself well to dropping the poly count of the model. And the other thing to think about when you're doing that kind of thing is scale issues, which you get when you have very large numbers or very small numbers on the screen at the same time. So if you're making a game where you travel between planets and you've got all your landscapes on every planet drawn with a calculated with a stochastic fractal, you want to have a system which can take into account when the planet's really far away and when it's up really close. So floating point numbers might not be big enough if you're dealing with real universe scales. static versus dynamic generation of data. All right. What this is about is procedurally generating content doesn't have to happen on the fly. So you don't have to load up the computer and then it's calculating everything as it goes in your game. You can generate the data and save it statically to disk, and some games actually do this. They generate a whole section of levels or whatever, store it to disk, and then later they can load them back up again. So that's a way to save CPU. It's always a trade-off between with these kind of algorithms between memory and CPU. for that particular algorithm, you can use fractal Brownian motion, which is this equation here. It just goes on forever. But do it however many you want. And that gives a much less uniformly random. So it doesn't just give you rolling mountains. It can give you sharp peaks and then flat planes and stuff like that. It's Perlin noise plus the fractal algorithm, basically. I'll talk about Perlin noise a bit later. Now I'm going to move on to L systems. These are my favorite. I love L systems. An L system is an iterator.
Is this where the love component comes in?
Sorry?
The love component of the
yeah, okay, there's a bit of love.
I'm sorry.
An iterated function, it's an iterated function fractal. So it's another one of these fractals which is made by recursively doing the same operation on a set of data. A guy called Aristide Lindemeyer studied the growth of algae, fungi and yeast. So he was like studying bacterial growths. And he came up with a way of describing the growth of an algae. And then his student, whose name I have no idea how to pronounce. Can anyone, I think it's Polish?
It's probably Prozenesla.
Aristide Lindemeyer wrote a book called The Algorithmic Beauty of Plants, which is the quintessential literature on the subject. It was the first one to go, hey look, you can make plants with maths. Actually, there's another one which doesn't use this technique, but it could generate ferns through a similar fractal technique. But, save that for another time. An L system can basically be described in maths like this. You've got the grammar, G, the alphabet of possible symbols. So you have a set of possible symbols, V. You have a set of constants, which don't change. And then you have an initial state. And then you have the rules of production. So the rules of productions are basically what you're doing is on each iteration you're taking your initial state and you're substituting symbols within it with their rules of productions. So you'll have like a symbol A, and you'll have a rule of production A is to AB, and then you'll have B is to B, for example. Then every time you see A, you replace it with AB. Every time you see B, you just replace it with B. So, and you keep doing that as many times as you want. You can iterate how many times you want. And eventually you get these long, complicated strings. So you iterate over them. In order to turn them into plant-like structures, what we do is we use a logo-like drawing system, which has a stack, which you can pop and push off, and the symbols become graphic commands. So has anyone here used Logo? Yeah, it's pretty cool. When you go forward, turn left, 20 degrees forward, that's basically all we're doing, and then you pop back to your original position. I'll show you an example. This is a little bit of code I wrote, and it's just very primitive, generates a 2D plant. And you can tweak, it's really fascinating tweaking the values and watching it just branch out all over the place. But I'll show you another much better one. This is actually written in a graphical data flow programming language called Pure Data. Has anyone heard Pure Data? So mostly used for audio processing, but you can do graphics with it too. Okay, so this is the example. And the cool thing about Pure Data is we can just grab variables here and move them, watch it change. So that one there is extending the length of each individual segment. You can see it's made up of segments which turn angles like this. So if I change the angle at which that looks like the trunk angle, I think he's actually got a two-layer algorithm where he's handling the branches and the trunk separately. But it's basically an L system still. He's just got more commands. And then, what about this one? What does that do? That's just rotating it. This guy here. Hey! On switch. Printed on switch. You'll have to bear with me for a second while I reboot my talk. How much time have I got anyway?
You've got about 15 minutes. So while you're rebooting, are there any questions so far?
That ill system stuff, we've seen that actually used for erosion. So they'll generate a height map of what they want something to look like, and then they'll do erosion over the top of that, and it'll pull the surface of it and actually like create gullies and stuff.
Oh, right.
And it uses that same sort of model.
That's cool. So that's like what I was talking about earlier with the landscaping system. You could have a system which was more realistic.
Yeah. That program
we
were just demonstrating there, is that
data
source?
Can
you download something?
Yeah, it's...
Put a URL in there.
Yeah. Well, you could email me. I know it was actually quite hard to get hold of because some guy wrote it and then it was hidden away in an archive that got lost and wasn't on archive at all.
You put it on a server.
The definition of an L system that looks an awful lot like the definition of a formal language.
Yeah. It's a. I think it's. It is a formal language.
Okay. We're basically instead of taking the existing results and following the rules to figure out if it's a sentence in the language, you basically just follow the rules of random to generate.
Yeah, well, you don't even, with L systems, there's no stochastic element to them, so there's no randomness in it. It looks, because it's so complicated, it looks random. You can throw random elements in there, you don't have to.
That triangle behind you, could that be done as an L system as well?
I think so, yeah.
Turn each line into line, turn right, turn left, line.
Yeah.
Pure data is in Debian and Ubuntu.
You can apt-get install pure data and apt-get install gem. Gem is the name of the graphics add-on for it. I'm going to have to go really fast through my next few slides. I've only got 15 minutes. I wasn't going to talk about algorithmic audio, but then last night I had a conversation with Rastaman where he was dissing it. But now I probably don't have time, so... Yeah, basically, you can write algorithmic music. An example of algorithmic music is Bach's music. He used to have a bunch of transformations which he would apply to a melody, and he would come up with these amazingly complex things, and then he would like improvise over the top of them. There's a couple of famous pieces. I think one of them, I don't remember what it was called, but the king at the time of Prussia or something gave him a little melody, and then he used these transformations to write this really amazing tune. So you can do that kind of thing, but algorithmic music generally sounds pretty crap.
Unless you're Bach.
Yeah, unless you're Bach. It's very hard to do it well, you know what I mean? But there are amazing geniuses out there now who do it well. The other aspect of algorithmic audio is on-the-fly sound effects. So not using... these days, sound in games is pretty primitive. Everything's just triggered samples. Maybe they put some 3D in there, but basically they're not... There's no reality to it. So if I knock a piece of wood, that didn't work. It doesn't sound the same both times I hit it, because after the first time I hit it, the wood's changed slightly. You know, there's very slight differences. But in a game, they just use a sample. Yeah. So you can use physical modeling to try and emulate real world sounds. Myself, I've in the past used physical modeling to generate samples, so it kind of defeats the purpose. But it means you don't have to go out and make field recordings. Spatial audio is another way of affecting your sound effects algorithmically, and speech, you can generate speech, of course we all know about speech synthesizers. Right. Cellular automata. Okay. So, we all know what cellular automata are, right?
Yeah.
Game of Life. Generalized version of the Game of Life. So the Game of Life was pretty much the first famous one that came along in the 70s, but before that, there was a guy called John von Neumann, who you might have heard of, he was trying to think up ways for robots to self-replicate themselves. And this other guy, Stanislaw Ulam, was studying crystallography and the ways that crystals grow. And Stanislaw had developed these mathematical abstractions to describe what's happening. And John von Neumann said, hey, those look pretty cool, maybe I'll try it. And Stanislaw actually persuaded him to try his self-replicating robots algorithmically. I've seen a really great cellular automata, which was someone had actually designed, I can't remember what the rule set was, I don't think it was Game of Life, but someone had designed a full computer in a finite state machine. So, I mean, not in a finite state machine, in a cellular automata. So he'd come up with ways to do logic gates and or all that kind of thing, and he'd come up with pathways. It's really amazing to watch. They have a web page of it. It's just like this massive, complicated thing.
Yeah.
And you can see the bits slipping in the memory and everything.
It is in fact
it's Game of Life. All right, wow.
That's Turing complete.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so cellular automata is Turing complete, yeah. So you have a bunch of rules which define the state of each cell. The grid doesn't have to be square. That's one thing. Like, a lot of people think that it has to be square, but there are heaps of cellular automata with, and they're not uniform space even. Sometimes cells touch other cells that are further away. There's all kinds of different things you can do. But you can use them to design AI or design textures. Dynamic textures is the example. I've got an example here. You all would have seen this before. I think it's in the Quake intro, actually. Java's going to probably crash everything.
There you go.
Yeah. Looks pretty wicked. Oh, 10 minutes? Okay, cool. All right, we're going all right then. So, that's what cellular automata can be used for. Think about textures that morph, textures that change, that kind of cool thing. Water. This is an example of a cellular automata acting in real life. So obviously the cells on the surface of this shell each have a little rule within them that follows a cellular automata-like mathematical progression. And they end up with things that look just like many of the cellular automata we know. It's fascinating. When imagine the first day a mathematician picked up one of these and went, holy crap, that's a cellular automata. genetic algorithms. These are my favorite genetic algorithms. So it's a computational method for simulating real-world evolution. So basically, you've got strings of data, and you're evolving them in a way that's similar to how evolution happens in the real world. You've got to have... it's good for finding solutions incrementally, so working towards a solution, rather than having... You know, it's good for situations where you have, like, say, an NP-complete problem, where the only way to solve an NP-complete problem is come up with every solution and look at the best one. That's the only way to get the optimal. So, in that case, genetic algorithms are quite good because they're better at getting you into the rough area. They're better than other systems like simulated annealing, which is where you jump around randomly. So, basically, for finding a solution, you need to have a fitness function. Determining each string of data, how fit is it compared to the other ones? And then you need to have an end state function which tells you, yep, we found the best solution we're going to find, let's get out of here. The basic process is much like real life. Select a subpopulation for reproduction. Recombine genes. So put your two data strings together in some way. So maybe you're going to take every second one in each one and then recombine them and then chop off the end or something. There's many different ways to do it. One of the problems I found with this area is there are so many different ways to perform genetic algorithms, so many different ways to write genetic algorithms that there's not enough science in it. People are just kind of going, oh, well, I'll select that number, this amount for how much mutation I'm going to put in the system. And it's still being explored, and I think it'll be being explored for quite a long time. But for games, we're just trying to get something cool happening, so it's good for that. You then do the mutation phase, where you might change, flip off a couple of bits, or flip on somewhere, some other, turn one letter so it's the next, something like that. And then you evaluate the fitness of the new population and select a survivor, so you kill off a bunch of the data strings that you have according to your fitness function. So you use your fitness function and go, yep, we'll keep that data, we won't keep that. genetic programming is where you take those strings and you actually use them in a virtual machine to run something. So that's oh, I've got a wicked video I've got to show you. This is my favourite.
What's it?
So I've got nothing incriminating in my bin directory. This is a guy called Carl Sims. He was experimenting with genetic algorithms, and what he was doing was mutating these objects, which were made up of polygons and then some kind of physical motor or something like that. And he actually got them to...
Swooping speed was used to determine survival.
I'll let him,
Most of the creatures are results from independent evolutions. Some developed strategies similar to those in real life.
This is 1984.
Once they're evolved, multiple copies of these creatures can be made and simulated together in the same environment.
Has anyone seen the Spore videos?
Evolved for their ability to move on a simulated random environment, like gravity and friction. Some simple solutions with just two parts were found. Some seem like they could use some assistance.
Skip forward a bit because we have a lot of time. Sorry, but you can get this on the archive.org. Just search for Carl Sims with a game.
Galloping-like stride.
That was cool.
This group was evolved for their jumping ability. Mean to nerd
was they start
the
fighting.
End of a simulation.
Yes.
Here, some covered the cube with protective arms. Others simply unfolded onto the cube. Here are two similar hockey strategies battling it out.
I mean, it's extraordinarily lifelike, isn't it? It's really amazing.
Yeah.
The strategy is this two-arm technique that swipes quickly in from the side and moves the cube over to a second arm. These are final rounds of competition amongst the overall best. Finally, the seeker arm goes against the side swiper, but the cube is just out of reach.
That's one of my favorite videos. Love that. Okay, so that's genetic algorithms. I won't go too much into random number generators or what is random. 5 minutes? Okay, cool. You guys are all into computers. You know about the issues surrounding randomness, what is randomness, and cryptography and things like that. And the problems they have with computers not being able to generate random numbers. But this Mersenne Twister is an excellent example of random number generator for games. It's not cryptographically secure, but it has a large period, so no repetition for a long time. It's fast. It's invented by two Japanese guys. And it's great for games. It's very simple to calculate. The other cool random... Well, it's not a random function, but it uses randomness within it. It's Perlin Noise. Ken Perlin invented Perlin Noise when he was working on the movie Tron. Yeah, lots of the textures and stuff in Tron are based on that. And you see it all the time now. Yeah, it's very natural looking. It's three-dimensional with the values normalized between -1 and 1. Basically what you do is you have noise functions and you sum them at different frequencies and amplitudes. So you don't just get a noise function, you get a self-similar noise function. And it's that whole, it's a fractal type of noise. Generally people use for each consecutive stage twice the frequency and half the amplitude. All right, voids. This guy called Craig Reynolds came up with voids. They're lifelike automatons that can move around and be aware of their flock mates. So it's really good for simulating flocking. The movie Jurassic Park used Craig Reynolds' algorithm when on that in that scene when all those raptors are running across the field. And what I love about it is it's really simple. It's got these three rules. Basically, you just have a vector, and you just add up vectors for each rule. So your first vector is an avoidance vector. You've got your local flock mates around you, and you don't want to hit them. So you have calculated an avoidance vector away from all of them. The next thing is to steer towards the average heading of your local flock mates. So you take the heading that all of them are pointing at, and you go, yeah, okay, I'll adopt the average of all of that. The next one is to steer to move towards the average position of them. So you're actually trying to stay in the center of your flock. So those three vectors put together make this really remarkable flocking behavior. I've got another Java one here. Yeah, this is an example of some flocking happening in 3D. And there's great, KFish has excellent examples of flocking on his homepage. So if you search for KFish flock or KFish Boyd, and Craig Reynolds' page has heaps of info on it. You can see these polygons are all flocking together in three-dimensional space. It's pretty exciting. And the great thing about it is, because it's just adding vectors together, if you want to add other behaviors to your beings, your non-player characters, you can do that really easily. So by you can add a path-following algorithm to make them follow some path, or an object avoidance algorithm. Finish it up?
Yep.
Yep, okay. So basically, that's everything anyway. So the idea is to shape randomness, use simple algorithms to get complex output, and let's make an open source massively multiplayer online game using each of the techniques we've described. How cool would that be? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for... This is a token. You get to choose one.
Cool.
They're different types, so if you prefer white, I think the white may have gone on.
That looks pretty good, thanks.
That's South Australian one. Okay. We're going to take a break for about 5 minutes, and then Rusty's talking about West North next. So don't go anywhere.